X is for Podcast Mutants, Magic, and Marvels is brought to you by the Cage Club Network. So for all things media, check out cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And for all things X is for Podcast, check out X is for Podcast on Twitter and YouTube. Hey everybody, it's Nico, and that means this is X is for Podcast, your premier comic podcast for modern Marvels, Cronus Given classics, and more. You can check out the show at xisforpodcast.com and X is for Podcast on Twitter. As for me, you can find me at Nico Action, that's NicoAction on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm so excited about today's episode because it's a really great opportunity to take a look at what happens when Marvel says, let's evolve a character a little bit. And one of the things that automatically kind of brings to mind is how at this point going forward forever, Namor is like Nick Fury levels of different from Namor. That's just gotta be a thing now. And even if we get some sort of luxuriously beautiful, hey, what's up? Incredible Mesoamerican inspired Namor, he's still gonna be different than Namor Mackenzie. So I am really eager to take a look at the ways in which Deadpool and Punisher have both transformed so radically under this new direction of where Marvel is going and Marvel's focus on committing to quality of storytelling, not necessarily singular identity of character preservation. It's something that we definitely applaud here at X is for Podcast, especially in this Krakoan age, which has allowed the X-Men to become something so much more than they ever were. And we're going to kick things off with that look at Alyssa Wong and Co's incredible first issue of Deadpool, which we were all just, you know, absolutely 10 Caesar salads about. And I promise you'll understand after you check out the segment. Hope you enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome back to X is for Podcast. I'm Nico, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NicoAction. That's NicoAction.
Hey everybody, it's Nathan. You can find me at Twitter at Desler AOA. That's like Desler in the Age of Apocalypse, where you can find me talking about better pickup lines than nice needles.
Hello, it's me, Steve, and my pronouns are they and them. You can find me on Twitter at Howdy Duda. That's HOWDYDUDA.
And I'm TK. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at XNateXGrayX.
And I'm Jonah. You can follow me over on Twitter and Instagram at PeakJonah. That's P-E-A-K. And we hope you survive this experience just like Deadpool, because Deadpool usually survives just about everything.
I can't believe we're here to talk about a run of Deadpool. You know, it's one of those things where, like, there's like an overlap to these things where, like, certain cards have got to fall in certain places to have certain books come on to this show. You know, we carefully onboard with selectivity. And to hear that team favorite Alyssa Wong was going to have an opportunity to put their unique touch on Deadpool just was too good an opportunity to pass up. And before we can get into any of the incredible first issue by Alyssa Wong, Martin Coccolo, Niraj Menon, and VC's Joe Sabino, I want to get a sense of how everybody feels about the Merc and what side of the Merc you like. Are you all sorts of murky? Are you like Merc selective? You know, is there a Wade that you wade into, or are you kind of waiting on Wade?
I have never been a Deadpool fan. I've never read any of the previous Deadpool series except for Deadpool Secret Wars, which I think is really, really good.
Excellent reading. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal. And I liked Deadpool when he first showed up in X-Force, or more accurately, when Fabian Nicieza developed the character into the person that millions of people love today. Was fun and is more compelling than I think a lot of the later characterizations that I've seen in other comics. You know, Deadpool shows up even if you're not seeking him out. Most recently for me in Ben Percy's Wolverine. But I will say this, Deadpool's a character who's always super frustrated me because he's a character that I'm told is pansexual, and that is the characterization that would draw me to a character like him. I think a pansexual character with his sense of humor and with his abilities and his job description and his personality is just like a wild combination that would make for really compelling reading. And I'm sure it does for a lot of people. But whenever I've ventured in or seen Deadpool appear in other books, I'm often frustrated by how Deadpool's sexuality is treated as a joke in and of itself. And it often feels like it's punching down at queer readers, or just like not, like maybe it's not real. It doesn't feel like it's necessarily canon so much as it's like the joke is that Deadpool is maybe queer. And so that has driven me away from the character for like so very long. But venturing into this book with the expectation of reading like the first Deadpool series by an out queer writer, the difference was palpable immediately. I could feel the difference. Something changed and something clicked, and I like this character.
Deadpool was somebody who I kind of liked in the part of X-Force that I was reading, which was like, you know, when they got those purple outfits, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. He's like hitting on Teresa. Like, okay, this is fun. This is cute. Through the years, I kind of never super gravitated to him. The last series of him I probably read was Kelly Thompson's one. It was a really fun, good fun ride. But he's never been somebody who's, I've never gravitated towards him as a character. Until this issue now, oh my god, there's so much humor that hits in the right way for me now that, like Steve said, in other writers maybe felt like it was making fun of the idea of him being pansexual.
I distinctly remember Deadpool's first appearance. That was when I was a very young comic book reader, and there was so much I never understood and didn't really pick up on. I just didn't find him to be a character that I thought was particularly special, and I always kind of wondered if it was because I was super young and like kind of wasn't getting something, like if it was all references that I didn't know. And for a really long time, that was kind of my thought process about the character. I felt like I just kind of didn't get him. And I feel like the first time I started to have him click for me was when he was with X-Force in the like Second Coming Messiah War era, when he was part of the Wetworks squad. And that was just what it made me realize, is that Deadpool can be a really fascinating asset to a team book under correct type of writer. Steve, I think you hit the nail on the head for what a lot of queer readers are going to feel, which is just that the queerness is at best promised and not delivered on, and at worst it's very much a punching down, a, oh, this guy is so crazy that all he can do is want to fuck everything. And
yes, exactly that. It's very negative stereotype of pansexual people in general.
Yeah, and you know, similarly, he does a lot of what with any other character, and particularly one under a queer writer, would be like gender fuck cosplay. But with him, it's just he's so crazy he wants to wear Jean Grey's clothes.
Isn't that funny?
It's hilarious. I can't stop laughing at a dude in a skirt. Who would have thought? I think there's endless possibilities with the idea that he is this just completely open person, like there are no limits for him, but it's never really treated as that. So I find that I enjoy him under a team umbrella where he doesn't have to do all of the heavy lifting with his humor that's going to be really hit or miss, but he can be kind of a voice of chaos and disruption. And then you get these just moments of really profound beauty or sadness. Like he's the only whole reason Evan Sabiner existed, and his unwillingness to, in this particular incident, kill a kid, you know, whether or not you found that believable, I just, for me, it all really gelled quite well. As much as I may not have loved the later incarnations of the Avengers Unity Squad, I did feel like putting him in that book was something that made it really interesting. The relationship that he had with Rogue, to me, it read as believable, as something that I was willing to follow in that book. So, you know, Deadpool as this like, potentially humorous, very chaotic person, I really, really like that concept. It just changes so wildly based on who is writing him that it's really tough to sort of commit to an opinion about Deadpool.
So I've dipped my toes very lightly into the pools of Dead. He's a character that I know enough about from cultural osmosis, because Deadpool is a very popular character, I think, for very casual comic fans or fans of comic book character media, not exclusive to just comic books themselves, but movies, video games.
The Walmartification of Marvel. Yeah, I very much agree with you. 1,000%. No, like not derogatory, but I agree with you. Yeah, like you can just kind of see Deadpool everywhere. 1,000%.
And that's part of just because Deadpool is a very marketable character. You know, he's this very sassy, fourth wall breaking, crude joke making, funny guy with guns, katanas, grenades, explosions. It's really a lot built into this character for casual appeal that makes him so popular. And there's nothing wrong with that. I can't really speak to Wade himself because I haven't really read a lot of stories. So I don't know a ton of the Deadpool characterization. I know that he's supposed to be pansexual, but I hear the grievances of my fellow podcasters, and it sounds like that hasn't been really handled properly in the past.
Supposed to be pansexual is accurate.
Yes.
I know that he had like a thing with death and he kind of like cucked Thanos a little bit, which I think is kind of funny. But like outside of that, Deadpool is very similar in more ways than one to Wolverine, in the sense of you kind of put Deadpool in a title if you kind of want people to buy it or you want people to see it. That being said, I enjoy Wade. I enjoy Deadpool, but in enough dosages where here's the thing. When you have Deadpool, I think a lot of writers, for whatever he's appearing in, really try to punch up how to make him funny or the scenarios funny. And for me, I think that can really test the waters of a writer of how well they can write comedy for this character while mixing it in with the superhero genre and a lot of explosions and, you know, shooting guns. I get wary because I don't know every writer's take is going to be that good mix of what I'm looking for if I'm trying to read Deadpool, of give me a funny moment, give me moments of him breaking the fourth wall where it feels like, you know, genuine and cool and not really overdone, but also give me enough of that action that I'm kind of craving.
And you know, I very much get where the kind of there's an expectation of Deadpool, I think, in a lot of ways. We think Deadpool is going to be this particular character, and you know, he kind of has Wolverine syndrome in that way, or maybe Spider-Man syndrome. Your Spider-Man is either a photographer or a scientist or a college student, or you know, making deals with devils to trade marriages. That's just so cute. He's just like, I don't know. Anyway, I always think that's the silliest storyline ever. It's just so silly you kind of have to giggle. But anyway, I really hear what everybody's saying. I really had a problem with Deadpool for a very long time. He was a little too torturing women kind of for me a really long time. And that made me feel just kind of ooky about him. And then we hit a point where he was like, there was nuance and there are some really thought-provoking runs that I definitely want to go back and give another read before I say that. Read it. Go out and spend your money. But I remember having a lot of really positive reactions to the Joe Kelly run at the time. And thinking, you know, the art was also just really staggering. But it really took me a long time to come to Deadpool. I really was not a Deadpool guy. I really always saw myself as being like, yeah, one day when I'm done growing up and maturing, I'm going to be a Cable. And I just sort of realized in the interim that nothing seemed like more fun than inexplicably pulling out a giant mallet and smashing something on the head. And, you know, it's there's something kind of fun and free about Deadpool. And it is a shame that one of the ways they don't let him be free is his sexuality. As a pansexual disaster myself, I look for that in pansexual characters, because if it's not there, then you're not doing it right. And it does matter. I don't know. I want to see the multitude of something you're claiming represented. If you just show single shades, it just kind of winds up the same problem Deadpool always falls into, which is I don't think shouting food is funny. I just like chimichanga, we laugh. Okay, but like switch it out. Yeah. French toast, no one's laughing. You know, like there's Caesar salad, no one's laughing. It's like in
so
it's kind of funny. I almost burst out laughing when I said it.
Caesar salad.
Yeah. Right? Like, that's ridiculous. I definitely agree that Deadpool misses the mark. Now, I mean, I don't just wish that Deadpool would be a whole lot queerer. Something that I wish they would play up a lot more in general is I love Deadpool's avuncular side. There's something about seeing him with, like, the Wolverine kids that's always really kind of cute.
Him and Gabby is so adorable every time.
So good. Is there something about Deadpool that you look for that, like, when you hear that's in a Deadpool story, you're like, okay, maybe I'll pick pick up that one.
Yeah. No, I love that side of Deadpool. I love the side of Deadpool that we actually see even in this first issue, which is a guy that, like, you can sympathize with in any way. Like, sometimes Deadpool is written in such a way that you can't, like, it's very difficult to sympathize with him. He's not only annoying to the characters in comics, but he's annoying to the reader, or he's portrayed as, like, creepy or predatory or, like, just an insufferable bore. But in this issue, it's like, you know, he's flirty and, yeah, it's like fight banter in some way, but it's also a little bit like, you know, he's genuinely interested in people. And he's the kind of guy who, like, if I see this guy get his heart broken, I'm going to actually, like, feel bad for him. And I'm going to be like, oh, that sucks. Like, I want something good for this guy. When this guy gets hurt, I feel bad about it. Often when Deadpool gets hurt in a comic, you're supposed to be like, yeah, that's good. Like, that's funny. Or, like, this shit happened to him because I'm annoyed at him. Or this character, like, Wolverine's really pissed at him being around. So, haha, that was good. But in this, like, there's a lot of times where, like, Deadpool gets hurt and it's funny because it's extreme gore, but it's, I see it and I'm like, ouch, poor guy. I hope he gets better soon, you know? And that's not something I'm used to feeling about Deadpool, at least not a lot of time.
I'm with you. I want a sympathetic. That's why, like, you know, when people are like, oh, but don't you just feel for Batman? No, not ever. And, like, you can push Deadpool into Batman where I'm just like, sorry. And so seeing a Deadpool where I'm like, oh, dude, no, I hope you get better soon, man. Sorry about your entire body. I'm completely with you. I really want to see a Deadpool that compels me to care, because I'll be honest, like, I really, like, I famously don't like the uncanny X-Force era. That's like an era that never really, we don't have the same tuning frequency. And I still think the Deadpool being like, Evan, no, cool nephew, won't let you kill him. I still think that that's very effective.
So the only reason I love Uncanny X-Force at all is because they got Betsy in her original Captain Britain uniform again. Although minus the wig, but besides that, yeah, I get you.
I forgot to mention my really, like, the big Deadpool thing that I read and it made me really like him was Cable and Deadpool. I think I forgot to mention it because it's so infrequently referenced anymore. But, you know, Nico, you mentioned him in this kind of mentor uncle role. I really like him as a brother or a sibling, not to make it too weird, but it seemed like despite the kind of romance thing, what was actually happening with Rogue was a lot more of a fraternal relationship that was just confused by everybody's situation. But I really
that
like
family
him.
Really blurs the two.
Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah. I mean, clearly after that issue of Legion of X with Nightcrawler, we're just all over the place. But I love the idea of him in that sibling role. The other thing I'm always going to check for in any particular Deadpool story where my hopes are up is, have we decided to make the serious characters absurd, or are we pulling Deadpool a little closer to, you know, maybe quippy, but not just everything is a joke and they won't stop. And, you know, we are saying chimichangas every other. If we are not making the serious characters way more absurd, and I get that kind of sibling relationship for him, I think he's a really fascinating character because he is in some ways, I mean, to the audience, he is really at his best likable, and he's a protagonist worth following. And so there's a real reward in seeing a character that just can't deal with his bullshit finally see that there is a person under all this. There's a very flawed person, but there is somebody who is trying to connect. And I think when that connection actually happens, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, I do particularly enjoy the Cable and Deadpool relationship and the Spider-Man and Deadpool relationship for those reasons. Even Daredevil and Deadpool is a fun time.
Yeah, what draws me to a Deadpool story, exactly the same thing, though. Yeah, when you get the juxtaposition of the personalities, like, obviously Cable and Deadpool is like, they're like polar opposites, right? In some ways, personality-wise, you know. Obviously, they have some very strong similarities. I also like it, the stories that take the time to show him not as just the like ultra violent mercenary that just goes around making quips. Like, I like the stories that show that he actually does have a heart still. And I think one of the things I really liked about one of the stories, like, hated all of, what was the story where Captain America became a Nazi and then took
Secret Empire?
Secret Empire.
Secret Empire, yeah.
I hated all of Secret Empire, but I did like Deadpool's role in that. You know, like, he was so proud he joined a team, even though they were all villains, but he was so proud that Captain America asked him to join a team. He didn't even question what was going on because he's like, Captain America asked me to do this. I have to do this. Those are the kind of Deadpool stories.
Captain America asked me to be an Avenger and they never asked me to be an X-Man.
Yeah.
So there are so many Deadpool stories for us to source from. I want to point out that Marvel Legacy, God bless them. You know, any god you want, just at random, you know, they are something else with some of these numbers. I love where they come up with them because they count Cable Deadpool as a Deadpool series, but not a Cable series. And I know it's because Cable doesn't finish out the series. I know. But the fact that they count none of the Cable toward Cable's count is, I don't know. There's, you know, there's some number playing here, but they found that the first two miniseries should count as the first 8 issues. I definitely agree. The signature series that ran 69 issues follows that, followed by Agent X. Love that they included that, big fan. 50 issues of Cable Deadpool, then a 63 issue series of Deadpool that launched in 2008, another volume of Deadpool that launched in 2013, which ran 45 issues, followed by the 2015 volume that ran 36 issues before renumbering to 287 and terminating at 300. Since then, we've had two more volumes, the 2008 series by Scotty Young. This was, you know, whenever I hear like Scotty Young is on a book, and I mean this like really positively, I'm like, ooh, boutique take on the character. It should be, you know, fun and kind of different. And while this wasn't like super groundbreaking for Deadpool, if anybody has a chance to check this out, I do recommend it as a fun, self-contained read with a lot of nods to a lot of great Deadpool eras. It's still really a light read without having to do a lot of research. And then, of course, though we covered it, we loved it, we thought it was amazing, need every page of it, Kelly Thompson run from 2020, where Deadpool took his rightful place as King of Staten Island.
Which is where the monsters live, right? Staten Island? Oh,
yeah, and Jonah. So, like, it's everything's scary, right?
Mm-hmm. I can confirm Staten Island is overrun by monsters.
The aforementioned Deadpool relationship with a number of people, Spider-Man and Deadpool's relationship was mentioned, and it's worth then mentioning that Spider-Man and Deadpool had a 50-issue series. Deadpool is sort of famous for his number of series, to the point where Deadpool has a near Conan number of omnibus editions at 12. He has Deadpool Beginnings, which sees a bunch of early stories, Deadpool by Joe Kelly, which sees, of course, the Joe Kelly run, Deadpool Classic, Deadpool by Daniel Way has 2 volumes, Deadpool by Posehn and Dugan has 1 big old volume, 4 volumes of the Deadpool Minibus, which numbers 0 to 3, just to fuck with you a little bit, I think. Deadpool and Cable, which is actually Cable and Deadpool, but I love it. And then Deadpool and Co., which has things like Marvel Zombies and Lady Deadpool, Prelude to Deadpool Core, Deadpool Core, all sorts of ridiculous shenanigans. And it's just unbelievable how many pages this character has in collected editions. In collected editions alone, the character has over 10,000 pages. So it's just like, my goodness, Deadpool. Guy's an empire. The guy is, I'm pretty sure the guy pays some bills at Marvel, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that much is very clear.
Not to mention the movies. I mean, the fact that he has been successful. And he's been one of the really few things out of the Fox X-Men that is going to come over to the MCU pretty much whole cloth.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about them importing Origins Deadpool whole cloth, and I don't know why.
Oh, no.
I hope if we're going Secret Wars, then both versions of Ryan Reynolds' Deadpool have to, like, look each other in the eyes.
Oh, absolutely.
And Origins Deadpool is like, I understand. Don't worry. Throw me in the volcano. Absolutely. There's a volcano. I don't know where it came from. But, you know, I think it's so funny because, you know, if you look at the numbers and, like, the payout on stuff, you could even say that the second Deadpool movie was less successful. But the less successful of two mega event films, I think still have such a reverberating effect on fandom. As much as I think a lot of us always really connected with Negasonic Teenage Warhead, you know, creepy, I'm gonna die on this island real quick, and then also creepy John Cassidy, China Doll Girl, you know, it wasn't really until Deadpool was just like, hey, here's Negasonic Teenage Warhead in my movie, the inclusion of an X-Force of sorts in the second one. Ooh. There's really something of sorts, I swear, I don't count it.
I'm not booing you, I'm booing that movie. It's...
I
could you even a star like that?
Oh, so egregious. I was like, I'm trying to get in Gadriva, Gadriva Javis, but like it just winds up sounding like a ghost type Pokemon.
On the other hand, though, Zazzy beats Domino.
Oh, yeah, amazing.
Chef's kiss.
She should play Domino in every movie they ever make about Domino or have Domino in.
I mean, Domino's just that lucky, isn't she? Right? Yes. So,
No, that's Roulette who you're thinking about, who's just that kind of lucky. I'm sorry. No. I messed it up. It's not Roulette. It's Shamrock. No.
I was like, Roulette's luck is, woo, that's scary luck.
I would really love Deadpool's contest of champions to follow up Deadpool's Secret Wars. That would really be quite an event. So, okay, an amazing conversation about a character that I really do think accurately pays a lot of the bills at Marvel. We're here to talk about Wong, Kokolo, Menon, and Sabino's Meet Cute, Deadpool number one. There was a big fuss and a big to-do made about this title, and I think that makes a lot of sense that there wasn't a Deadpool in print for a hot minute felt really strange. And so seeing that it's back on the shelf where it goes, sort of anchoring in an earlier letter for the X-Men, I know that sounds silly, but like without Excalibur, there's kind of less of a presence all over the wall. It's just something that catches my eye, having worked in a comic shop, that X-Men is always on the bottom right corner, you know, of the wall. You have to find it oftentimes, right? So I don't know, I always just thought it was great that Deadpool was up there representing the X-Men. Not too much X-Men here, but one of the things there is right away is fucking Harrower. And I don't know how many of you fucking read Man-Thing with us, but
the Man-Thing, that was amazing.
She counts as an X-Men character, if only for her connection to Horde culture.
And then she was mentioned in the X-Men Green stuff we just covered, me, TK, and Jonah. So like, it's literally like, this is Harrower's moment. I think Harrower should be on the next vote. Fuck off, Firestar. This is Harrower. It's Harrower's time. She has a horse for Emma Frost to kill.
Wait, is Harrower a mutant?
I don't think
I don't think so, but like, I don't care.
It's magic.
now I'm just imagining Firestar, like right after you kick her off the team, she's giving a "Don't call me Firestar" speech.
Right, so this is what happens when you let Firestar be on the team at the same time as Havoc. You get people saying that non mutants should be on the X Men.
Well, I mean, I just want to see Harrower have her time.
Yeah, I really like her in this issue. I didn't remember her from Curse of the Man-Thing, which, to be fair, like, I'm sorry to the people, but I don't remember a lot from Curse of the Man-Thing, unfortunately, at this point. It's not been that long.
It had a lot of that vibe where, you know, like, there was that minute where somebody walked into the DC Vertigo office and was like, Karen Berger. And she was like, yes, 1997, I'm very stressed. What's going on?
Yeah, I totally get you.
I have these three miniseries. And she's just like, fine, just do them. Neil is leaving. And like, I feel like that's what Curse of the Man-Thing felt like. One of those John Nehriber, Gaiman is leaving. What do we do? What do we do? I don't know. Quick, somebody have, I don't know, who was doing the highly painted, John Muth, do a painted cover. Like, it's got that vibe.
I mean, the thing that is really cool, though, is, I mean, I remember during the interview that we did with Alyssa, they, you know, we of course asked, is there any way you're going to be doing something in the X office? And they said, you know, stay tuned, a little tongue in cheek. We all knew that we were going to be expecting something. I think probably the last thing on my list of like guesses would have been a Deadpool series. And yet, as soon as it happened, it immediately just started making more and more sense to me. And on top of that, it's really exciting that this is putting Deadpool firmly under the umbrella of the X office, to the point that, yeah, you can have a Deadpool title that isn't super X heavy. And yet, little things like the inclusion of Harrower and the fact that it's Deadpool make it feel like this is definitely an important part of the X story and the X universe. And, you know, I think we might be looking at little hints here and there based on the inclusion of the symbiote that this might even be starting to touch on some dark web stuff. So it's just a really exciting time to like have the eccentricities of what counts as X stuff be really plugged into this book.
Yeah. Speaking of the symbiotes, I'm very much looking forward to the Summer of Symbiotes next year. I'm looking forward to it because I started reading Al Ewing and Ron B's Venom and Carnage, and I have so many questions about this particular Carnage symbiote. there's a moment where Harrower says, "I'm going to put some Cletus Cassidy in you," and my brain was like, "Wait, where is Cletus right now?" I had to do some searching actually to figure that one out. Did you know how many Carnagers there have been? But that's a story for another day.
Yeah. So one of the things that really does bring to mind is that this book, by incorporating Doc Ock and Carnage and Deadpool, who has had a title with Spider-Man for 50 issues, I feel like then we're in a position to say this is very possibly dark web connective in some regard. If the X-Men and Spider-Man are on a collision course, Deadpool comes popping back up with a bunch of spider things going on, featuring an X-Men villain who's been connected to horticulture. I don't know. There's just, not to mention Mary Jane, the whole Moira thing, yeah. You know, yikes. But like, you know, that's a Red Sonja move of Moira, if you ask me.
Oh, bravo.
That's some straight up Red Sonja shit.
I am okay? Very impressed with that reference.
I tip my Stone Age hat to you, sir. So I wonder very much about the nature of this intersection. I would love it if this was a point of synergy, because otherwise I feel like maybe Spider-Man, get your shit out of my X-Books. So, but like, if this is a point of synergy, I would be into it. How do you guys feel about the fact that so many X-Books are moving with spider-like precision in the next few months?
It is such a cool thing, because you know who's writing Amazing Spider-Man right goddamn now? Yes, that's right. Beloved Hellion scribe Zeb Wells. Beloved X-Men artist John Romita Jr. Like, I cannot wait for this mashup. I think it's fated to happen at this time. Yes, Marvel has put the pieces in place, but I'm looking forward to it. I'm a Spider-Man fan now. It's a new time. It's a new dawn.
I always love the interconnectivity between Spider-Man and X-Men. I love that when Wolverine died, he was like, or Logan died, he was like, "Hey, kid, I want you to come teach at the school." Like what? But like, it's just, I love the series that they've had together, the guest appearances in each other's book. It's always a fun time. So I'm totally digging this and loving it.
I haven't read Curse of the Man Thing just yet, so I wasn't familiar with this character. And I was like, ooh, she, not to always compare characters, but like, she kind of has some Poison Ivy vibes over from DC. But instead of being this powerful, bisexual green lady, we have this white lady, and she has opinions and things to say. She fully planted a seed inside of Deadpool, and I was like, oh, okay. I kind of really enjoy this. I kind of enjoyed this characterization of the Harrower, because it felt like, okay, we have this character with the ulterior motives, who's kind of just like feels sympathetic to symbiotes, but like wants to use it for her own personal gain in a way that's like, I feel like you feel bad for this, but also I feel like you're still in the wrong. Like, I want to root for you, girl, but I can't, but I do. It was very funny.
And that's kind of like the funny thing about horticulture as well, is like, you know, horticulture is making some valid points, but they're in the villain role, so we're going to play around with that. And I do think it's really cool that Harrower has this other connection to the X-Men now, besides now being a Deadpool villain. Nico, as you mentioned, we just got a really cool reference to all of this and Curse of the Man Thing in X-Men Green. And it does feel like, even if we're not driving towards a specific thing, like Dark Web, we are seeing a really solid attempt to connect a bunch of characters and a bunch of plot points to the X-Men, to Deadpool, to these villains, and to kind of make it a lot more believable that you will encounter these people in association with Krakoa, in association with, maybe even in association again with Man-Thing. I really like when, I especially appreciate that Alyssa Wong is not Steve Orlando and is picking up on the stuff that Steve Orlando, like seeds that Steve Orlando planted in, like Harrower, seeds that Steve Orlando printed in a bunch of different books. books. It just, to me, everything right now feels really strong. And like, there's a bunch of characters now that I can see being in any number of X books, and a bunch of plot points that I could see being in any number of X books. And I would feel like, you know, that wasn't shoehorned in at all. That the seeds were really planted for that. And it's an interesting read.
And speaking of, I don't know if something is seeds planted or if it's just sort of like synergy across titles, that that's where things are going. But I was thinking about the fact that, you know, when Steve, you said that Deadpool popped up in Wolverine, I was like, no, he popped up in X-Force, didn't he? No. Oh, no. Right. And it's both, actually, at this point, which is the thing. And so where else? Oh, it's one big book. It's an interesting use of the dual format in a very classic way. And that's exciting to see played out in a different context. That pause is going to edit out well. And I think for me, with Deadpool's main power in many ways being his unkillability. Yeah, you know, that he's like the Merc with a mouth is cool, but like he can't die. In the most recent two appearances of Deadpool that we've seen, Ben Percy's X-Force and now this, I feel like Deadpool's unkillability is now his greatest weakness. And that's something that's interesting to see both Ben Percy and Alyssa Wong pick up on as two different authors. I feel as though Deadpool being challenged for the reason that he is usually lauded, his ability to, you know, go real balls to the wall for the team, is a dynamic transformation of the expectation I have of Deadpool as a character.
And Alyssa Wong said right off the bat when this series was announced that it was going to give us some really solid body horror, and I think they leaned into that perfectly.
Yeah.
Yes.
If Deadpool can't die, there has to be something in superhero violence that is of some kind of consequence to him. And it's gonna look like body horror. It's going to look like that idea that it would be better to die than feel this type of pain and this type of disgust. And I think just stating a Cletus Cassidy symbiote is high up there on that list of like, this is worse than death.
My absolute favorite page in this issue is like, it's the splash page where Deadpool is getting a plant vine through his chest. But it is like, I've seen this happen a million times to him even recently, you know, but like, I don't know, the dynamism, the kinetic motion of this page, the way the composition fills the space in like a spiral around Wade's body, the perspective of the hand coming out, the gore of it all, and the three-dimensionality of like the second page where things are coming out of the borders. Like, Cocciolo is doing really incredible work. Like, I really love the art on this book. I think Deadpool looks hot as fuck. I don't usually think Deadpool looks hot, but he's like a beefy boy. He looks really good. The clothes look really good on the body. Everything is just like, it's hyper well-defined, but also cartoonish and also studied. And I don't know. I'm just saying good things about that at this point. The art is amazing and the gore is really good.
And there's a levity to the colors that I think really bring the pencil work out so powerfully.
Yeah,
it kind of looks like a level from Sonic.
I can totally see that. All the greens and reds clashing with each other.
Yeah, there's something that's like classic kind of pinball-y video gamey about it. And there's a magic to it. The art in this is so luscious as well, because, you know, it's frankly kind of masturbatory. I am very like, you justify your splash pages to me, comic. But like, you know what? As many as you want.
I have recently read some comics that have wasted splash pages, and I see none of that here.
Oh, yeah. Even when you just expose that body horror with, like, the pose that Harrow has in that next page, when the plant is pulling back out of his chest, like, she's got that classic supervillain pose. I love how it's at the same time modern style with a little bit of that hyperbolic 90s style, with a lot of fun and whimsy, and everybody's really fucking hot in it.
Well, while we're on the art for one moment, I need to hit up that splash page that is just absolutely everything. Location 8, where we have Harrower in front of this beautiful magic sphere, and she just looks like she's ready to decorate your ranch. And I am so in love with the sort of excess that was spent on pages like that, on page like 11. I just want to celebrate how nice nice it was that this book, while perhaps then felt a little decompressed at times, so it felt like a long read, like a really long read in a good way. It felt like the art celebrated the length of the book in a way that felt fun to read.
Also, I gotta give them props for the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia Pepe Silvia moment on digital page 16.
1,000,000,000%, yes.
If there's one thing I can trust Alyssa Wong with is putting in a good meme reference. Alligator Loki is full of them. Their short story with Deadpool over New Mutants has one of my favorites. Gabby, what do you have? A grenade? No! Where did she get a grenade?
And the Carly Rae Jepsen lyrics?
Oh, it's... Yeah. Alyssa is a big old fan of meme culture, and we love to see it.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that I really was interested in with this book is we have a writer who is not associated with Deadpool's typical style of humor. How is the humor going to play in this book? And as it started, there were moments where I was like, is this maybe a little too deadpan? But as the book picked up, I really started to get that they were essentially just doing an entirely different style of humor for this character. And it is such an important counterbalance to the years of just absurd juvenile humor that we've had for Deadpool, to just have a couple slow burn jokes and ones that, you know, you maybe miss the reference the first time around when he says the thing about being wet and then Hera says, you must not be used to that. Just like that we're having the villains banter back when normally they would just say how frustrating he is for talking too much.
Yes.
I got so excited that we could finally have as proof of concept that Deadpool could be nonstop cracking wise, but when the jokes aren't so 13-year-old child, it becomes actually really fun and funny to see him be that.
Yeah, TK, I am so glad that you brought that up. Like, I was just saying to Nathan before we got on the call about how specifically that one page where Deadpool writes a bunch of pickup lines down and then crosses them out, how much that single page says about the character of Deadpool in this run as opposed to previous runs, that these are all a bunch of extremely low-hanging lazy jokes that are the exact type of jokes that I often read Deadpool saying. I would imagine several writers would just jump at the chance to use all of these in a single comic, but these are things that Deadpool looks over and goes, no, these aren't good and I shouldn't do that if I actually want to date this person, and crosses them out and tries to think of something better. He's not necessarily moving in a warmer direction, but this is great because these jokes get to become jokes for the reader, but they also get to be like a little bit of like, Deadpool's actually self-aware enough to know that this is not going to work if he actually wants to like pursue this person.
And the exciting thing is we could attribute this to his growth as an attempt to really become part of Krakoa and to sort of live up to this community culture that is trying to achieve something greater. And this could be the starting point for a new style of Deadpool that could become the default. I know this is asking so much, but a new style of Deadpool that could become the default where the level of humor gets elevated, even if we just say ever so slightly in a lot of cases, to the point that a lot of readers who love a funny book but maybe just aren't going for the same like poop and dick jokes can finally have a chance to really follow and fall in love with this character. And I think it could have the added benefit of
sorry, I was like, oh, his name is Deadpool. How can it? Dick poop. Perfect. It's just so stupid. I'm so sorry.
No, please. That's perfect. No, just, you know, the idea that if we can retool the humor a little bit, we will not only move away from gender and sexuality jokes, but his gender and sexuality might actually be something that we can explore in a way that's both authentic and humorous.
Yes. The thing that I desire most is for queer writers to be able to tell queer jokes without the joke being that queerness is funny or weird or different.
Yep.
I just want that. I want people to be able to tell even dumb and low-hanging jokes, lazy jokes even, as long as they are jokes that are like by and for the community that they're about. It would be so great.
That was actually part of my defense of the Curse of the Man thing. It's okay for queer people to write something really
nothing
basic.
Against Curse of the Man thing. I love the Dark Riders. I just wish they had gone anywhere else.
I wish it had done anything. Nathan, I'm so sorry. You were about to say my apology.
No. I was gonna make a really off comic joke. I was gonna be saying, say this should not be this hard, but I
like Deadpool says.
Deadpool says, yeah, you know, it's literally in there.
It's a line in the comic.
Deadpool says it. It's not your fault. I want to very much talk about something that, Steve, you said you're excited to talk about, and I could not be more excited. I love any time a character in a comic stands out so powerfully that, you know, it makes you do research to see if the character existed before or if they're new. It's always such a blast. So you had said you wanted to talk about Valentine.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about how I love Valentine. Valentine is so beautiful. They are awesome. They have little needles on their fingers that makes them seem like part of the Deathstrike family, of which Lord is here.
Lord who is giving very dandy vibes, if nothing else.
Lord is
but is dead. But is dead. Yeah, I just need to remind everyone is dead. Recently dead.
Lord Deathstrike is dead and loving it and looking very fine and dapper in the suit. It is exquisite. I love how it looks with the sash on it. The mask, impeccable. The red lipstick, incredible. There's a person here who is surely an alternate universe version of Ravana the Terminatrix. Last Bite, who is obviously a vampire. Like, I took one look at that character. I was like, that's a vampire. Done. Yeah, there's a few other really interesting characters. There's a woman with a ginkgo tattoo. There's the Horned Emperor, who is like, goals? The Horned Emperor is like a faceless cloud of black smoke for a head, out of which rise two very long antlers. Black form-fitting outfit with long gauntlet gloves. Heavy gold jewelry hanging from the neck, a hot pink ruff, and an ascot at the same time. So this book is great, but Valentine is my favorite because Valentine is just so beautiful, so cute.
I love that Horned Emperor smacks of Xenomorph somehow anyway, like Horned Xenomorph. It's very like, there's some Moose vibes too. I'm here for it. This congregation of nonsense characters is so wonderful because you want each one of them to have some significant portion of the story, even though that, you know, wouldn't make any sense here. And I don't know. I just really thought these were such interesting characters. And I agree. I loved Valentine so much. I was like, is this someone I don't recognize? I know I've skipped a bunch of Deadpool runs. How did everybody feel about this incredible additional series of characters that Alyssa and co have infused the book with?
So I was very excited at this idea of this elite assassin group, and I will say these character designs did not disappoint for me. I am assuming most of these, if not all of them, are completely new, which I think is cool. I like that we have like a really wide range of kind of characters that are expanding across like different mythos. Like, we have a fairy here. I don't know how common fairies are in the Marvel comics, but I think that's really cool. And I like seeing a lot of playing with character design that feels fun and feels fresh and exciting. I do wonder their role in the larger Deadpool story at large, but I also wonder, you know, this introduction of this new group brings about a lot of different questions for me, like how long have they been operating? Do they always choose high profile targets like Dr. Ock? Is there a gruesome initiate target? Dr. Octopus is not an easy target, and I understand the idea of, okay, this has to be a very hard to kill mark because they're not going to let anyone in, but that's like expecting a baby to beat a world-class champion in boxing. I don't know who's killing Dr. Octopus.
I also had the same thought, and I'm like, they're totally setting Deadpool up to fail because they don't want him in their club. If any of these people had ever killed anybody on the level of Dr. Octopus, I'd know who they were.
Exactly. Like, I know some of them have appeared before, but I don't know who they are, but the assemblage of this whole odd villain, like, premier assassin league, and, like, nobody knows who they are is so insanely cool.
Totally valid points on the fact that, like, this is a group maybe you would think it was more plausible if we'd heard of before, or was featuring more members we'd heard of before. But I do love just a random throw-in you know, especially when it could give us like literally more than half a dozen new villains we could play around with. I'm down for that. And when the art really keeps up with the character concepts, these are all, without very much description or page time or anything, pretty solidly fleshed out characters in terms of, you know, if anybody saw these and in a year said, I want to pick up Mirror, which nobody has touched or done anything with. Mirror has such a like specific look that even if you were to say, oh, it was just from one issue of Deadpool, you can already kind of hit the ground running with what you would do with them in the future. So I think it's pretty amazing when you can just through one splash page and very little else create this many characters that get the reader excited. Valentine, of course, is pretty next level as far as this goes. We do get a little more page time for them, but Needlefingers, I don't know. I was obsessed with it when Michelle Pfeiffer did it in Batman Returns, and I will probably be obsessed with it for the rest of my life. Needlefingers always works for me. Always sexy. The just kind of smirk on their face and the confidence and subtlety with which they approach Deadpool. This just feels like a really good character to play opposite Wade in a romantic setting such that we're not getting the same beats. It's the same thing as the humor. The relationship here, I don't think will be like very many or any that we've seen with Wade in the past. And I think that is something that this character needs if we want to grow them beyond the kind of juvenile origins that they've had. It is such an important bonus that this is really now paying off on the fact that Wade is pansexual. There are plenty of ways that we could have visited this. I would have hated if he had just been into a muscular white dude. This really gives us something to work with for Wade and making him a more complex, interesting character.
It absolutely does. And it gives us a like a primary protagonist of the book who is pansexual, not just in the like funny haha way and not just in the binary gender way, but like his main love interest is a like explicitly non-binary character who will presumably be an ongoing like major character in this book. That's exciting. That's so exciting.
And you know, one of the things that it makes me think about is perhaps the fact that we always see Deadpool with either the guns in his hands or the swords in his hands, and there's sort of a duality to that, not being oversimplistic, but just sort of analyzing the idea that Deadpool is like a trained fighter. Deadpool does know how to fight with swords. Yeah, I mean, he totally can charge him with guns, and there's nothing uncomic dynamic about that, I guess. But like, we all know that Deadpool knows how to charge in. It's sort of the nuanced run that takes the time to show that Deadpool has skill and grace. That's like, Deadpool has grace. I mean, he's a fuckwit, but like, you know, every Wade Wilson can walk, Deadpool can walk softly when he wants to. And I think he doesn't always just stamp loudly and disturb his downstairs neighbors. And I think with that in mind, that Deadpool is someone who needs that sort of dexterity showcased, genuinely. I think, I'm being like, I don't know, because it's definitely about the sexuality for me. As a person who is pansexual, I do care about that on every level. I want to see sexuality showcased. I think it goes deep to a problem with this character on every level, where every part of the character frequently gets oversimplified. And it just feels like this specific issue is avoiding all of those oversimplifications. And it's hard not to praise all of them. I think part of what I'm getting tripped up on, I just want to be like, Alyssa, listen, here's all of the things you guys nailed. I just want to let you all know, and then be like, end of list. And like, you know, like there's nothing negative to list. Like, I don't know, not to overpraise it, but this was a pretty close to perfect issue for me with Deadpool. I was charmed beginning to end.
Oh yeah.
This is the best I could expect from any Deadpool book. And I know that sounds like faint praise, but it was also a really good first issue. It sets up a lot of stuff that could be really interesting in the series, and I'm going to be reading more. And I don't know if I would have if it was another series. You know, I think this series is phenomenal for a first issue. It's phenomenal for any issue of a Deadpool book, as far as I'm concerned, and it's phenomenal for a current X-book.
What I'm really waiting on, I'm a little bit worried about, but I remain hopeful because sometimes humanity surprises you. Will this humor prove able to resonate with enough of the readership readership, such that this isn't seen as the niche one-off Deadpool book that wasn't really Deadpool, because we all know how Deadpool's supposed to be. Can we as a fandom agree that we are ready for a new style of Deadpool writing and that it fits our canon for this character and can be how we see him going forward? We do not need to return to chimichangas again.
Yeah, I mean, well, it is funny. I think Alyssa Wong is extremely funny in this issue, and it isn't lazy humor, at least most of the time. And when it is, it's self-consciously lazy, like the meet cute repeated joke bit. Like, it's a book that takes writing jokes seriously, at least so far. And I think any reader of a Deadpool book would appreciate that, or at least I like to imagine they would.
I'm hoping you're right. I'm worried about those, you know, 12 to 21 dudes.
Oh, I hear you. I don't think you're wrong to be afraid.
I want to challenge with perhaps, though, that's the art of where Alyssa Wong's dexterity of format comes in. Something that really sprung out to me is this is the first time I have felt perhaps that a printed book read like it was intended for digital. And there was something very about the number of splash pages and their placement and the number of pages that might as fucking well have been splash pages or felt a little bit like a video game scene where I'm just getting like the quick cut scene just to keep the plot moving, because the stuff that's happening there really doesn't need an FMV. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like there was a lot of places where the format of this book, I think, eased the gay. Like, I don't mean that mm-hmm. like too, like, I think you might be like, oh, okay, well, it got faggy, but like, it's good faggy. I don't know. It was the faggy went fast, you know, like, and that's whatever gets.
Sorry, can we back up on the faggy went fast here? Just,
oh, of course.
In this book is so horny in the art. Like, Deadpool standing with two legs over that like monstrous mouth of a creature with the tongue on the page wrapping around his groin. There's that also that scene where he's like literally getting bitten on the ass, and he says a joke about eating ass. Somebody calls it dine and dashing. Yeah. Very funny.
Oh yeah, Deadpool is famously horny.
I love
it. I want it to be everything that you're saying, Nico. And it's not that I like cannot believe it's possible. It's just we've all been burned before with comic book characters and how hard people choose to lean into the lowest common denominator bits of those characters. And I understand why, because that the common denominator means it's more people. I'm just, like I said, I'm hoping we as a fandom have gotten to a point where that common denominator can be a slightly more elevated level of humor, and where a character like this being attracted to other forms of gender and other expressions of gender than, you know, just being heterosexual, that can be seen as a cool thing, or, you know, as something that doesn't get in the way of a particular person enjoying or identifying with character. I am rooting for.
I'm with you 100%. Absolutely.
I definitely have faith in it. I think I've seen a subtle like shift in the last few years on how they've let Deadpool sort of get a little bit more of a mature humor that's not as offensive versus like the 13-year-old, like, you know, like, ha, dick jokes, boobies. There has been a shift on it. So I think this is just a natural progression of it. It's not super out of character, but like if you were to jump straight from the 90s, like Deadpool, like, yeah, that would be really out of character.
And there's a potentiality to this book that I really want to see explored. If we're going to reinvestigate the sort of internal horrors of Deadpool, one of the things that's exciting about that is the Weapon X program is the most disgusting thing ever. And that's a place I love to go. I mean, unfortunately, like, you know, just I love the Weapon Plus program, all of it. It's just like, it's my canon. It's canon I love way too much. And for better or for worse, one Dr. Nathaniel Essex has grossed out all over it a billion times. We're entering the, you know, the endless summer of Sinister or whatever. the sins of Sinister. And it makes me excited for the potentiality that maybe with, you know, Wolverine does canonically have connection to Sinister through Kieran Gillen in Origin 2. Perhaps we're going to see a little bit more of that Weapon Plus thread tested, and maybe that'll be the opportunity to see Alyssa Wong maybe come a little bit more into the X-Fold. I love seeing this incredible army of queer writers running through the X office the last couple of years. It's been incredible. But it does seem to focus a little bit more male-heavy at times, and it would be nice to see it maybe balance out a little bit better. You know, Nathan and I were recently talking about how the main writers to run all the way through with no skips in their track record are Percy and Dugan. And TK, you were there as well, and we were saying how it was sort of shocking that there has been no female or non-binary writer with an uninterrupted track record in the X office in the Krakoan age, the way there have been two heteronormative cis white males. So this could be an opportunity to, I mean, obviously they can't go back in time and fix it. Love it if they did. But I'm excited to see that this could mean maybe a little bit more X-Men Deadpool, especially with the number of X-Men Deadpool appearances in the last few months.
And I mean, it's just getting to the point where, for me, Alyssa Wong really can do no wrong. And the idea that they would be another person who could have their hands all over the X universe and have a title that ran a really long time and was so central to the machinations of all the rest of the X books, to me, that's a dream come true in every single way. And there are plenty of writers who I just wouldn't say anything. You know, I wouldn't say they shouldn't do it, but I also wouldn't say like they're my top choice. I'm talking about writers that I absolutely love, but I really can say that there are a handful of writers who I would say without reservation, I would trust to get the volume of work and the spread of work that guys like Dugan and Percy and Hickman have had in the X office these past few years. I just think Alyssa to me is a person that I have total confidence and excitement about when I think of them getting a body like that for this particular set of characters.
Alyssa Wong is one of those writers where anything they write, I'm definitely going to give it a shot and, you know, see if it's going to connect with me. And they made Deadpool connect with me as a reader in a way I really never felt before. I've enjoyed Deadpool series. Kelly Thompson's was amazing, but like this is the first time a Deadpool actually really connected with me.
Yeah, what more could I say that is any more than what TK and Nathan have said? I agree completely.
I am very excited to see where everything goes. I was really happy with this issue in terms of just kind of seeing Deadpool in a setting that feels like a step forward for the character. And I'm really excited to see what Alyssa is going to bring to the table for Deadpool.
I just want to see Wade not fuck up. Full stop. That's all I want. Dude, just like, if you can walk softly and not disturb your downstairs neighbors, then do it. And hopefully Alyssa Wong is going to take the time to craft something careful that, as much as it explores all of the, you know, hearty har of Wade, I'm looking forward to a little bit of the subtle gentle that is what makes a character have complexity, even one like Deadpool. Hey everybody, it's Nico again.
And I'm TK.
And we are here to talk about sort of the other side of character evolution. Still, very good things, no complaints. But really, if one of our big conversations in the last segment was, check him out, Deadpool's such a dude now. Oh man, Punisher's not doing the same sort of evolution in the same way.
Well, you know, we've had a little more time with Punisher, but I think my takeaway from the Deadpool segment was Deadpool needed to change, and lo and behold, Deadpool is changing in this run, and that could really be his future. We felt at the very start of this Punisher run that Punisher was really due for a big change. It was no longer sustainable to have this character continue to exist with the way that his symbol had been co-opted by real life vigilante justice. And the run of Punisher that we are well into now really changed changed Punisher, changed Frank Castle in a way that acknowledged the way that symbol had been co-opted. So two characters that I think I would have said at the start of their runs both needed to change. And like I said, Deadpool's just at the start of theirs, but I'm really excited for the future. Frank, we're quite a few issues in now at this point, and I remain really satisfied with the changes that have been made.
I agree. You know, it's not hard to see that Frank was at a real awkward dead end. And it's always so tough because something we talk a lot about on this show is sort of the duality of iteration, the many different characters that can exist in any single property. And it's like Marvel heard us and they're doing this like Murder World special thing where it's like Spider-Verse versus Murder World. It's a bunch of Wolverines, including AU Wolverines and other timeline point Wolverines versus Murder World. It's like a whole thing. But one of the things that is a little bit harder to deal with is sort of the John Constantine conundrum, where I remember there was a time where, like, as a Hellblazer reader regularly, I would be like, wow, yeah, John Constantine, I don't know, just got tricked into fucking a dog. And then I go over and in Justice League, he's like, oh, bloke, here's a magic spell I put on this card to give you butt what good luck. And then he and the other chimney sweeps would go off onto the roof. I'm so sorry, everyone. I'm so sorry. But, you know, it's that level of, it's a different character. And I feel like in Punisher's book, Punisher is like, I'm going to kill everyone on sight. And in Marvel crossovers, Punisher would be like, I've got your back, Cap. And Cap would be like, I'll look the other way on those murders because you've got my back. And I know you're really a good guy. And Punisher always puts up, you know, two thumbs with guns in both hands. And it's a nightmare.
I'm really just remembering War of the Realms and our coverage of Asgardians of the Galaxy.
It is one of those situations that companies often find themselves in with multiple interpretations of a character. And I was wondering if we were still going under the guise that we could pretend that Frank Castle was still these multiple people, that he is still also sometimes just kind of fucking Frank Castle, the way Daredevil, when he is Elektra, she is Daredevil is when Elektra is Daredevil. It's the same way when Elektra is Daredevil, hey, what's up, that she can still be in Savage Avengers and you're just like, oh, big deal character. Wolverine is in Canada and Australia at the same time. Sure. The thing that I think would make it really hard for me here is it's sort of like supervillain Frank. And you can't just be like, oh, this is before he gets really fire bug eyed. And I did a little bit of research and it actually turns out that in the last couple of years, there have been next to no Punisher appearances. We have Savage Avengers 15, King in Black number 3, Savage Avengers 23, Timeless number 1, then Daredevil Woman Without Fear number 3. Then this run of Punisher. There have been a few other things in between. Something in the recently released Adam Goldberg Damage Control. Evidently, I'm a little behind on it. Adam Goldberg, real cute. But I don't know that... I checked out the first issue. It was cool. Just, you know, when you read something and you're like, this isn't going to be given the same treatment as something that is seen in continuity. It had a lot of, this is not going to be continuity to it. So I'm not sure what his contribution there was, but God, I hope it had the fire eyes. So yeah, this is a, you know, cleanupification of Punisher. He's not doing the dual character thing. If Punisher shows up, it's Jason Aaron's reimagining of Punisher as the scary, scary monster man.
I think it's good to be using him less. I think the last 2 years, it makes a lot of sense that we would see a lot less of this character based on the co-opting of the Punisher symbol. And if he's going to exist, it really does have to be as a bad guy. And this issue, I think, does an interesting job of starting to get into how somebody can be pretty reprehensible and still be very human. Although I shouldn't say starts to get into. That's something that has been running throughout. And that's one of the things I've really liked about this. But this delves into a moment with Frank at his most vulnerable and sensitive after he has really started to embrace the darkness inside of him. And I think what really just impressed me about this is it never shies away from the basic premise that even if you can look at somebody's past and say this was a person that loved their children, that can never justify horrible wrongdoing.
I can't help but think about how much the justification for a lot of what these characters do comes down to our understanding of the package the book is in. I myself am a bigger fan of the Avengers just sort of go around saving the world. I don't need them to belong to a government. I don't need them to belong to an agency that belongs to a government. I sort of like my Avengers a freestanding body. Otherwise, it kind of gets into like super police instead of superheroics. And I understand that, you know, superhero comics at their core often go heavily toward the idea of super police. And my precious Matt Murdock, Daredevil, who we're going to get to this episode, is, you know, as a lawyer who often seeks justice in regard to his cases, very much a problematic character in that trope. But I think one of the things that helps indoctrinate a reader to a character is the summary page that each of these characters get at the front of their book. And while I'm not sure that I can speak to just how corrosive previous, you know, what's what, who's who, catch up to understand the book here pages have been, I do know that in the past, they have been framed to be less outright critical of Frank. And one of the things I really appreciate about this book is that from page two, you know, after the cover, once you're into the title, there's a lot of really accurate stuff. There's a few changes I would make here, but after a retired Marine, Frank Castle, okay, I just want to go out of my way to say, if you've read any of the Punisher has ever been to war stuff, he's not just like retired Marine Frank Castle. That's like dog owner John Wick. That's just not exactly the statement you make. It's sort of like Unbelievable has dealt with every possible superhuman you can possibly expect to meet in the jungle. I think at this point has fought early symbiotes. Like, there is a lot of things that they're just simply underselling with that. But sure, Frank Castle's wife and children were killed by stray gunfire during a shootout in Central Park. He began a one-man vigilante war on crime that he paraded around as in the name of justice, had acceptance from the superhero community, the law enforcement community, and always got the same sort of blind eye treatment, ultimately, culturally, that guys like Spider-Man would get, even if it was, oh, but he's the edgy guy. No, he's still a mass murdering serial killer, much in the same way that he tries to bring down.
Sure.
And he became the Punisher. I feel like that's about as close as you're going to get to outright coming for previous runs. But I think this really is important to note that while, yeah, I did want to put a little bit of flavor on it, this is not good guy Punisher has to take justice into his own hands to protect your daughters. This is, you know, guy got a gun, guy went a little nuts.
But I think it is smart to keep it very simple and let this run do the embellishing on the basic premise.
I agree, because this run also wants to sell you a specific product, and I appreciate it. Again, I find the work done on this previously page worth investigating because it highlights and expresses the things that are important. You know, you never want to be the script writer that's like, no, that's not how the line is meant to be said. But when you hear it said super wrong and you're like, I can tell the person's not getting the line, right? And I don't know if it's just beautiful coordination between Jason Aaron, the incredible art team of Jesus Seis, Paul Azaceta, Dave Stewart, and letterer VC's Corey Pettit, and their amazing connection with the editorial team of Martin Biro and Annalise Bisa, alongside longtime editor Tom Brevoort. But there is something so clever about the description in the first two lines on this page. The cult of assassins known as the Hand made Frank Castle an offer he couldn't refuse. Become their High Slayer in exchange for the resurrection of his long-dead wife, Maria. Frank is just one in a long line of fabled fists of the beast. Oh my god. He had no other choice. For them, he's just one. there is something so clear about how that really is the story here. And I think it's important to consider that when so much of this issue is a strange parallel to the Ares fight from just a few issues ago, and now it feels very differently framed and very differently shown, because I worry sometimes that there is going to be a fast one pulled on us, and not by any one person in particular, but there is always the concern that it's going to ultimately be, nope, Frank was in control the whole time and everybody doubting him is wrong. I do not believe that is an appropriate story at this point, and it would take the nimblest of footwork to get me to approach it.
I think I'm also really worried about what happens after this run and the next person who decides that they want to do something different with Punisher that sort of leads back into a hero track for him. But this one does feel pretty set in its ways, and like it's pretty happy to do whatever it can to show you that it's not going to try and buy Frank as a human being back for you within the pages of this particular story.
And I think that's the better move. I see a lot of value to Frank being moved away from who we understand him as, and it's why I brought up Namor earlier in the episode. I don't believe we need Namor to be Namor note for note. I think you can go to the movies and see a beautiful Latinx man rise from the water flying beautifully. I said so. And I think in the comics you can see, you know, the smarmy dark haired pointy ear man and just be fine with it. And, you know, that's okay. And, you know, comic Namor certainly has fans and value and history and a history of genocide that detracts from his value. But, you know, there is a lot of stuff that we are able to do as a culture that has moved past where we once were. And we can now see, it's that whole joke, you know, two people named Michael. Okay, then you can know two characters named Daredevil and they can exist in the same universe and it cannot actually cause your brain to split in two. Same thing here. I think you can have two versions of Punisher, movie Punisher, TV Punisher, what, you know, MCU Disney Plus Punisher, where he's probably going to be closer to his classic version, but hopefully they do something to fucking fix it. And then we'll have scary demon Punisher over in the comics. And I think that's valuable.
And I think that what we got from John Bernthal's Punisher was actually in a lot of ways much closer to this Frank without all the hand demon stuff. But it was somebody who was clearly broken by war and by what governments are willing to sacrifice in any given person that they will allow to fight for their country. But those things are not excuses for current wrongs being done. And you can acknowledge both that characters like Frank can experience injustice in their past and not say, and therefore, because of those things, they are justified in the actions that they take in their present.
Because if nothing else, one of the things that we're facing with a character like Punisher is how damaged his history is by the interpretation of time changing. And we need to be ready as a readership to either evolve the character or retire the character. And I see value to the things that John Bernthal brought to the character. There's a humanity to him. There's certainly a sense of humor and levity. There were moments that challenged my expectation between his show and Daredevil. Was it ever something I could be like, yeah, I root for this dude? No, not really. That's tough. That's real tough. He's just putting bullets in people. That's real tough to root for in general. So I want to see a version of Punisher in the comics that can sustain, that can have unlimited stories told about him, that maybe actually is a challenge to the understanding of what we're going to see going forward. I would love to ultimately come to a place where it's a major Marvel crossover versus the Punisher called Punishment. And it's just, you know, wild. And everybody becomes a sub beast of the hand. Like, you know, Sabretooth is now a sub beast of the hand. And I don't know, who do the Avengers fight? It's mostly just other people pretending to be Avengers, right?
Or vampires sometimes. Doom.
Yeah, Doom. Well, everybody's always fighting Doom. And there's dooms that fight dooms. It's insane.
It's true.
So I really think that the strength of this issue for me lies in the power of telling a compelling story for Maria. I have really been hesitant to connect with Maria and see what's going on with her. And it's almost as though when Frank is genuinely distracted by someone who would genuinely distract him, Maria could sneak in her story. And that sort of conflict, that sort of alienation of my expectation, really allowed me to, I don't know, I do not want to say that at least she was away from Frank, but this woman's life is like if Angela's ashes took place on Revolutionary Road during their Eyes Were Watching God. This is just like actual legitimate torture porn. It could only be Russian. This is Saw. I don't even know what to say.
It's very interesting to me the way that we take a number of issues to go through all of Frank's backstory to get into his teenage years where he meets Maria and she is the object of desire for a teenage boy. It takes a minute to get to a place where Frank can exit his own story and Maria, who is a side character in Frank's story, suddenly becomes a fully realized character as Frank goes off to war and basically stops being a character that we can sympathize with in the same way. He's about to cross a line that he can never come back from, that is going to lead to the Frank that we know that is the Fist of the Beast. And it's a really good opportunity to stop and say, hey, while you weren't looking, we decided that you needed to see Maria's side of things as well. You needed to realize that she was never just a side character in Frank's life. She was a character in her own life. And while she might not have the same like fascinating connection to the Beast in her past, such that we need to go all the way back to the beginning, you do need to see what she was going through in this particular period where her trauma started to dovetail with whatever is happening to Frank that is rotting him to his core.
Because he is decaying. And that's, I think, the thing that I find most interesting about the story. There's this notion that we have been following Frank as he's been, you know, trying to avenge his wife. And we see him reach this point where he gives into this dark thing. No, I don't think so. Jason Aaron is making the compelling argument that Frank has been rotting since day one. He was always a little fucking bastard. And he's the kind of kid that my Nana would have said, don't play with when we were at the bungalows. You know what I mean? And I wouldn't have. He really is awful. And with that in mind, this exploration of how since entering her life, Frank Castle has only depreciated the quality of Maria's being is really important to note, because it means that her murder as a result of being connected to Frank was just the next tragedy. The revelation here is that Frank was always rotting and that Maria was always slowly dying from it.
And also that it can be wrong for governments to wage war and send young men overseas to fight in those wars, and still that Frank reveled in causing death was also wrong. Frank is not a victim here. Frank went into the war to be a disciple of Ares and to feed that need for death that was always inside him. Doesn't mean it's okay that, you know, the U.S. government is an imperialist government. Those two things can both be wrong. Frank is still not a victim. And when he comes back from war, he has no more right to continue seeking out death and waging war than he did overseas. It's always a bad thing to do. It's bad when governments do it. It's bad when individuals do it. And we don't need to look at Frank and say, oh, but, you know, there's a good reason here. All of those things can be true. And it's also still possible that somebody who has done this kind of great wrong that is not excusable can still love his children. it's almost more insidious because of that.
Oh, agreed. You know, because seeing the whole, oh, he's taking care of his children and she understands in that moment, I'm not criticizing the writing. I only want to bring to the surface that the thing to point to is that this is not saying, you can understand how damaged and cold he is and forgive it because you see a powerful moment. No, this is the conditioning that she's in. This is where she's at, where his resistant, muted, and long overdue withheld forms of affection are the things that she thinks of in her. This is all she's got, man. These are the happy moments. This moment of relief that your children aren't dead and that your husband has slept in bed for the first time in years, where you don't feel like he's pacing trying to find his next victim. Jesus, this woman has nothing but sad memories. That her happy memories are her happy memories is a sad truth.
And that Frank is capable of love in this regard shows that he should know better than to do the things that he does.
And it's a little weird because I'm like, on how I was raised Catholic. That's, you know, something that was done to me as a kid. And I am not interested in organized religion. I am only interested in disorganized religion. And as a result, even though I'm still very about my daredevil, and I still have tons of aunts that say novenas, and I'm not judging anything. Sometimes when it's in Daredevil, I get a little like, okay. Like, only because I don't feel like there's a whole lot of room for anyone's faith to come up, like, magically on the battlefield. Like, it's not that I don't think that there's room for him to go to church and talk to priests and have pages of prayer. Then it's put in this really amazing context where all of a sudden, I really understand what's happening here. We're shown all of the Christianity and Catholicism through Maria, which recontextualizes it into normalcy. And then we have Daredevil have it be that he was taught it by Doctor Strange as a result of when he was possessed during the Shadowland event, when he served the same function Frank is serving now. So it's not out of belief that a hero would think this, and especially for somebody to have criticism of it, to be Daredevil is perfect. So then it's a powerful mystic teaching Daredevil to be mystically powerful in a way he understands. It's like mystic potency is an energy, and you need to understand the language to channel it. It's not necessarily that in that moment we see Daredevil via Doctor Strange confirm, you know, Cathal, the Catholic god. We get a clear depiction of the way that a man who has faith can use that faith to focus and channel magic as we understand magic in the Marvel Universe. And there was a really delicate balancing act to this. There was a really careful working of experience, of ability. And I think this was an example where Jason Aaron really showed why he's the guy to do this. That was really deftly done, because otherwise I would have really been rolling my eyes.
I think maybe your background with Daredevil gives you a bit of a leg up if you see this as like a really solid use of both continuity and some ideas around faith and magic. I see it as a good setup that I'm not sure if it pays off. And you explaining it helps a lot, but I worry about the lay reader who doesn't know as much missing some of the background beats that really solidify this. I did not have any of that information until hearing it from you. As I was reading this, I was kind of hoping that ultimately the message is exactly as you described it, essentially that, you know, the magic can function on faith. I even think that there's a dangerous precedent set there, because I think you then sort of have to have the counterbalance of there are times where people will invoke faith in moments where it's not really appropriate. And we have sort of empirical evidence. There are moments where empiricism sort of has to trump faith. And I would hope that this is a conversation that can be ongoing in the story and we can see that double-edged sword. But I was not 100% certain about this moment because I was kind of lacking in some of that background. And I am happy that it played out the way it did, but I do think that I'm sort of always wondering what each individual writer's relationship to Matt's Catholicism is, and if it is something that they're kind of holding with kid gloves because they really have no other choices.
And I do have, you know, respect for religion, and, you know, I wonder, though, the validity of the argument of being protective of Daredevil's Christianity and Catholicism, because if we go by the tenets of Catholicism, there is but one God, no, you know, honor no other God but me, and that's pretty like all the religions as a rule, not all of them, but it's like a vast majority of them are like, no, pay your taxes to me God, not them God. And as a result, we then enter into a fictional world where there are gods, like plural in a real chill way, and there are people whose names are literally the one above all, and it's not the one above all except for your particular God person who's reading this at the moment. It's changeable. It's one above all. And I think we can always be as protective as we want of a fictional character's religion, but we do need to remember sometimes that it needs to be metered really carefully. That is not to say that I want to avoid representation, because like I keep saying, like, you know, we have room for Daredevil to go to church. We have room for characters of any faith to express their faith. It is always important to me to then be very careful of it when you're using it to face off against Punisher, the gun-toting Fist of the Beast, who is a former super vigilante friend ally type creature guy. Like, it's, you have to be careful with it. And I don't know that we went too far here. I'm sure there's going to be people on both sides of it who have criticisms, and much of it is going to be really, really valid. I think what has to be driven back home then is Matt's sort of blasé attitude. Might have gotten a couple words wrong. No big deal. Gonna try again. And then Punisher flying and like emanating fire from every hole. I really loved the Frank, your eyes are on fire. Like, I really loved, because I don't know, Jason Aaron did not write my favorite Daredevil. Just, you know, Jason Aaron, I'm a huge fan of his work. Many times over on this show, I have been the loudest voice singing the praises of a man who is responsible for, like, seriously, like an eighth of all of the books coming out of Marvel in the last decade. But I don't know that his Daredevil really strikes me how I want it to. I feel like been little bits of it here and there, but I thought he got a lot of it really down. And for me, the portrayal of it as comic book Catholicism, magical exorcism power rites in the middle of a battlefield, that worked.
I feel you. I'm not 100% against it in any way. And I basically feel like it worked. I also think it really helps that this is coming off of Matt wrestling with the fact that in his own book, one of his college buddies just showed up and is like, oh, I'm actually an angel of God, and you are just playing a part in a whole heavenly play that we're all just showing up for. So Matt is being challenged on his own front as well. And I think putting that, Akka, who is another servant of the hand, is basically saying the same thing. So Frank is tied into all of this. There is a holistic approach to questioning one's personal faith and then how all of these different ideas of heavenly bodies and a greater or a bigger picture are playing out in the pages of these books. It's just, you know, I'm always a skeptic when I read this stuff.
And it is a necessary skepticism to keep in mind when you're talking about these kind of books, these kinds of stories with these hyper magical beings doing hyper magical things. I am curious about a lot of the bigger picture of what happened here. Did Frank just let Matt go? And if Frank just let Matt go, how is the High Priestess going to see this? And in that regard, seeing her call him the Defiler was really nice. she should hate him. And then the scene with Maria at the end, first of all, hey, Frank. Second of all, hey, Frank. And, you know, Maria, wow, for a character whose whole plot has been he wouldn't come to bed, bed became an incredibly lonely place waiting for him. He finally came to bed. And now I realize that every scene we've seen of them together has pretty much been them laying in bed together. But now he can't ever come back.
The Rubicon that we kind of passed was them trying to get out and Frank realizing that it wasn't possible. And now he really is trapped in this situation where I think we still haven't wholly dealt with the fact that he's not getting his kids back. But he is, I think, not realizing that he's not even keeping ahead of this whole thing anymore.
I actually wonder if what we're going to get is Punisher sort of becoming like Super Beast, maybe overtaking the Beast and like forcibly resurrecting his children. Like, I wonder if we're going to get some sort of big epic story in that regard, because after Maria says, why do they call you the Punisher? Great question. That leads me to those two pages with Ares with hand slaves, which is just like pulling his sled slaves. I don't know, hand sled slaves. It's insane. And Ares is about to declare war on Punisher. And we've seen some solicits and some covers, and it looks like Punisher might put up a semi-decent fight. It would be the cyclical nature of the storytelling that Frank would a little bit overcome his former opponent and be the victor at some point in the story to further the darkness of his arc. So I think this could be the time. And I worry very much about what that means for so many of the characters, their safety, and where this run might terminate. Is Frank, as the Fist of the Beast, going to be done with this story at the end of this run?
I do wonder, and again, I refer back to that moment with Akka sort of confirming that everybody is playing a role in something else, and the fact that we have seen Akka speak to Frank and confirm that they are in cahoots, essentially, that they are on the same team. It makes me wonder if Frank will make it all the way to the eventual confrontation between the Hand and Daredevil and Elektra, or if Frank is maybe one very large domino that sets up the next step for the Hand that will be the confrontation.
I hope wherever it is, it has lasting repercussions that do ultimately move the characters forward. I feel as though a lot of the lessons learned in Shadowland didn't really stick with Daredevil, and it would be nice to see that sort of weight be taken seriously. Especially for Punisher, a character who really needs the dramatic declaration of enforcement into this new form. Teek, it's been amazing talking all these books with you and taking a look at some characters that have really taken on new life in the last couple of years, and I look forward to continuing these discussions with you.
Can't wait.
Until then, where can everybody find you online?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at xnatexgrayx, and of course you can find me all over this show on Mondays talking about MC2 totem people. I don't know, we're all over the place, but we're talking about cool stuff. And then of course Wednesdays and Fridays talking about books new and old.
You can find me those same places with that cool guy all over this show. Plus you can find us both on the Partner Network over on YouTube, Hubs Plus Network, where you can find extended versions of this show, The Billy Club, our examination of Daredevil. That's myself, Tori Sheehan, and our producer, my amazing husband, Kevo, as well as a number of amazing other features. Don't forget, you can find the show at xisforpodcast.com and xisforpodcast on Twitter, and me at NicoAction on Twitter and Instagram. That's NicoAction. And until next time, keep those mutant lights lit, those Krakoan gateways open. Remember, Frank has always been the villain, legit, and we'll see you.